Okay, welcome everybody to the Savitri Reading Circle on Infinite Conversations. I'm here with Andrea, John Robert, and Jeffrey Jen. My name is Marco. And we are about to do our first reading of Canto 4 in Book 3. So, Book 3, the Book of the Divine Mother, Canto 4, The Vision and the Boon, which is the last canto of the book and also of Part 1. Of Savitri, and we'll begin with a meditation.
Canto 4, The Vision and the Boon. Then suddenly there rose a sacred stir. Amid the lifeless silence of the void, in a solitude and an immensity, a sound came quivering like a loved footfall heard in the listening spaces of the soul. A touch perturbed his fibers with delight. An influence had approached the mortal range. A boundless heart was near his longing heart. A mystic form enveloped his earthly shape. All at her contact broke from silence sealed. Spirit and body thrilled, identified, linked in the grasp of an unspoken joy. Mind, members, life were merged in ecstasy. Intoxicated as with nectarous rain, his nature's passioning stretches flowed to her, flashing with lightnings, mad with luminous wine. All was a limitless sea that heaved to the moon. A divinizing stream possessed his veins, his body's cells awoke to spirit sense. Each nerve became a burning thread of joy. Tissue and flesh partook beatitude. A light, the dun, unplumbed subconscious caves thrilled with the prescience of her longed-for tread, and filled with flickering crests and praying tongues. Even lost in slumber, mute, inanimate, his very body answered to her power. The one he worshipped was within him now. Flame pure, ethereal tressed, a mighty face appeared, and lips moved by immortal words. Lids, wisdom's leaves drooped over rapture's orbs.
A marble monument of ponderings, shown a forehead, sight's crypt, and large like ocean's gaze towards heaven, two tranquil eyes of boundless thought, looked into man's and saw the God to come. A shape was seen on threshold mind, a voice absolute and wise in the heart's chamber spoke. O son of strength, who climbst creation's peaks, no soul is thy companion in the light. Alone thou standest at the eternal doors. What thou hast won is thine, but ask no more. O spirit, aspiring in an ignorant frame, O voice arisen from the inconscience world, how shalt thou speak for men whose hearts are dumb? Make purblind earth the soul's seer vision's home, or lighten the burden of the senseless globe. I am the mystery beyond reach of mind. I am the goal of the travail of the suns. My fire and sweetness are the cause of life. But too immense my danger and my joy. Awake not the immeasurable descent. Speak not my secret name to hostile time. Man is too weak to bear the infinite's weight. Truth born too soon might break the imperfect earth. Leave the all-seeing power to hew its way. In thy single vast achievement, reign apart, helping the world with thy great lonely days. I ask thee not to merge thy heart of flame in the immobile's wide, uncaring bliss, turned from the fruitless motion of the years, deserting the fierce labor of the worlds, aloof from beings, lost in the alone. How shall thy mighty spirit brook repose while death is still unconquered on the earth and time a field of suffering and pain? Thy soul was born to share the laden force. Obey thy nature, fulfill thy fate, accept the difficulty and godlike toil for the slow-paced, omniscient purpose live.
The enigma's knot is tied in humankind. A lightning from the heights that think and plan, plowing the air of life with vanishing trails. Man, soul awake in an unconscious world, aspires in vain to change the cosmic dream. Arrived from some half-luminous beyond, he is a stranger in the mindless vasts, a traveler in his oft-shining home amid the tread of many infinities. He has pitched a tent of life in desert space. Heaven's fixed regard beholds him from above, in the house of nature, a perturbing guest, a voyager twixt thought's inconstant shores, a hunter of unknown and beautiful powers, a nomad of the far mysterious light, in the wide ways, a little spark of God. Against his spirit, all is in dire league. A Titan influence stops his Godward gaze. Around him hungers the unpitying void. The eternal darkness seeks him with her hands. Inscrutable energies drive him and deceive. Immense, implacable deities oppose. An inert soul and a somnambulist force have made a world estranged from life and thought. The dragon of the dark foundations keeps unalterable the law of chance and death. On his long way through time and circumstance, the gray-hued riddling nether shadow sphinx, her dreadful paws upon the swallowing sands, awaits him armed with the soul-slaying word. Across his path sits the dim camp of night. His day is a moment in perpetual time. He is the prey of the minutes and the hours.
Assailed on earth and unassured of heaven, descended here unhappy and sublime, a link between the demigod and the beast. He knows not his own greatness nor his aim. He has forgotten why he has come and whence. His spirit and his members are at war. His heights break off too low to reach the skies. His mass is buried in the animal mire. A strange antinomy is his nature's rule. A riddle of opposites is made his field. Freedom he asks, but needs to live in bonds. He has need of darkness to perceive some light, and need of grief to feel a little bliss. He has need of death to find a greater life. All sides he sees and turns to every call. He has no certain light by which to walk. His life is a blind man's buff. A hide and seek. He seeks himself, and from himself he runs. Meeting himself, he thinks it other than he. Always he builds, but finds no constant ground. Always he journeys, but nowhere arrives. He would guide the world, himself he cannot guide. He would save his soul, his life he cannot save. The light his soul had brought, his mind has lost. All he has learned is soon again in doubt. A sun to him seems the shadow of his thoughts. Then all is shadow again and nothing true. Unknowing what he does or whither he tends, he fabrics signs of the real in ignorance. He has hitched his mortal error to truth's star. Wisdom attracts him with her luminous masks, but never has he seen the face behind. A giant ignorance surrounds his lore. Assigned to meet the cosmic mystery, in the dumb figure of a material world, his passport of entry false, and his personage, He is compelled to be what he is not. He obeys the inconscience he had come to rule and sinks in matter to fulfill his soul.
Awakened from her lower driven forms, the Earth Mother gave her forces to his hands, and painfully he guards the heavy trust. His mind is a lost torchbearer on her roads. Illumining breath to think and plasm to feel, he labors with his slow and skeptic brain, helped by the reason's vacillating fires, to make his thought and will a magic door for knowledge to enter the darkness of the world, and love to rule a realm of strife and hate. A mind impotent to reconcile heaven and earth, and tied to matter with a thousand bonds, he lifts himself to be a conscious God. Even when a glory of wisdom crowns his brow, when mind and spirit shed a grandiose ray to exalt this product of the sperm and gene, this alchemist's miracle from plasm and gas, and he who shared the animals run and crawl, lifts his thought stature to the immortal's heights. His life still keeps the human middle way. His body he resigns to death and pain, abandoning matter, his too heavy charge. A thaumaturge, skeptic of miracles, a spirit left sterile of its occult power by an unbelieving brain and credulous heart, he leaves the world to end where it began. His work unfinished, he claims a heavenly prize. Thus has he missed creation's absolute. Halfway he stops his star of destiny. A vast and vain long-tried experiment, an ill-served high conception doubtfully done, the world's life falters on not seeing its goal. A zigzag towards unknown dangerous ground, ever repeating its habitual walk, ever retreating after marches long and hardiest victories without sure result, drawn endlessly an inconclusive game.
An ill-fitting and voluminous robe, a radiant purpose, still conceals its face. A mighty blindness stumbles, hoping on, feeding its strength on gifts of luminous chance. Because the human instrument has failed, the Godhead frustrate sleeps within its seed, a spirit entangled in the forms it made. His failure is not failure, whom God leads. Through all the slow, mysterious, through all the slow, mysterious march goes on. An immutable power has made this mutable world. A self-fulfilling transcendence treads man's road. The driver of the soul upon its path, it knows its steps, its way is inevitable. And how shall the end be vain when God is guide? However man's mind may tire or fail his flesh, a will prevails, canceling his conscious choice. The goal recedes, a bornless vastness calls, retreating into an immense unknown. There is no end to the world's stupendous march. There is no rest for the embodied soul. It must live on, describe all time's huge curve. An influx presses from the closed beyond, forbidding to him rest and earthly ease. Till he has found himself, he cannot pause. A light there is that leads, a power that aids. Unmarked, unfelt, it sees in him and acts. Ignorant, he forms the all-conscient in his depths. Human, looks up to superhuman peaks. A borrower of supernature's gold, he paves his road to immortality. The high gods look on man and watch and choose today's impossibles for the future's base.
His transience trembles with the eternal's touch. His barriers cede beneath the infinite's tread. The immortals have their entries in his life. The ambassadors of the unseen draw near. A splendor sullied by the mortal air, love passes through his heart, a wandering guest. Beauty surrounds him for a magic hour. He has visits of a large revealing joy. Brief widenesses release him from himself, enticing towards a glory ever in front. Hopes of a deathless sweetness lure and leave. His mind is crossed by strange discovering fires. Rare intimations lift his stumbling speech to a moment's kinship with the eternal word. A mask of wisdom circles through his brain, perturbing him with glimpses half divine. He lays his hands sometimes on the unknown. He communes sometimes with eternity. A strange and grandiose symbol was his birth, and immortality and spirit room, and pure perfection, and a shadowless bliss are this afflicted creature's mighty fate. In him the earth mother sees draw near the change foreshadowed in her dumb and fiery depths. A godhead drawn from her transmuted limbs, an alchemy of heaven on nature's base. Adept of the self-born unfailing line, leave not the light to die the ages bore. Help still humanity's blind and suffering life. Obey thy spirit's wide, omnipotent urge. A witness to God's parley with the night, it leaned compassionate form from immortal calm, and housed desire, the troubled seed of things. Ascent to thy high self, create, endure. Cease not from knowledge. Let thy toil be vast. No more can earthly limits pen thy force. Equal thy work with long unending times.
Traveler upon the bare eternal heights, tread still the difficult and dateless path. Joining the cycles with its austere curve, measured for man by the intimate initiate gods. My light shall be in thee, my strength thy force. Let not the impatient Titan drive thy heart. Ask not the imperfect fruit, the partial prize. Only one boon to greaten thy spirit demand. Only one joy to raise thy kind, desire. Above blind fate and the antagonist powers, moveless there stands a high unchanging will. To its omnipotence leave thy work's result. All things shall change in God's transfiguring hour. Do you want to stop here and discuss a bit, or?
That would be a good idea, I think.
There's a lot in this bit.
Andrea or John Robert, the last time we met and we spoke about the previous canto, The House of the Spirit and the New Creation, one of you, I don't remember which, mentioned that that canto in particular was a favorite or a beloved canto of longtime Savatry readers. And I have the feeling that this may be one as well, but I'm not sure. I'm wondering what you all think.
We actually, after we were done, I realized that this is the one that they kept reading, The Vision and the Boon. Yeah, so you're right.
What would you say is the particular importance of this canto?
I think we should wait till we've read the whole canto. Because they're here right now, just like she says, just for you, I'm here, right? It's too quick for mankind. But he's not going to be satisfied with that. You can expect that for sure. Just like later, death argues, or Savitri argues with death, and she's not satisfied until she gets what she wants. And here, the mother is actually arguing with him to become just that himself and leave the world to its omnipotence, leave thy works result. All things shall change in God's transfiguring hour, indicating, kind, implying that that is not now until where we just read.
Because the last canto was all up in the sky. And this one seems to drive us back down into the depths again.
That's the whole point.
Yeah.
It's got to come down here, right? He had the whole, he was there. And now he wants to bring it down. Because he's not doing this for himself. He's doing this for us, for everyone. Yeah.
And what's this one boon? Joy.
One boon to greaten thy spirit. Only one joy to raise thy kind desire.
There appears to be this tradition of boons. When you meet the Godhead, you ask for boons. And we will see this later. And as Andrea was implying, there's a parallel here with the Savitri's when she debates with death. And so, and in the original story of Savitri and Asrapati in the Mahabharata, Savitri also debates with death in that. It's much shorter, of course, than this. And he grants her, death grants her boons because he's so impressed with her, how eloquent she is. So this seems to be a tradition of requesting from the gods and receiving or not receiving a boon or more than one boon.
But the issue here seems to be that it's one. It's not like there's a kind of like keep your eye on the prize message.
Yeah.
Here, like, don't be distracted by other things you may desire, other things you may want. Like that, it seems that this vision that the traveler is having is kind of trying to redirect his attention and bringing it back to his humanity and the burden that remains to be borne in order to fulfill the particular purpose that has been invested in him.
Yeah, so it makes me say this line on the previous page, ascend to thy high self, create, endure, cease not from knowledge, let thy toil be vast. It's like we got to do the work.
That is a pithy command.
Yes. Thank God for Mother Aurobindo that they were up to the task.
Question is, are we? Or is one?
The thing that strikes me about this part of the canto is after the Divine Mother starts speaking, she really emphasizes the contradictions in humanity. And she goes on and on with that. An inert soul and a somnambulous force have made us a world estranged from thought. The dragon of the dark foundations keeps unalterable the law of chance and death. She just goes on and on with that. And then all of a sudden, she switches and she says, his failure is not failure whom God leads. And then she starts talking about humanity's possibilities and the various things that a light is there that leads, a power that aids. Unmarked, unfelt, it sees in him and acts. I thought it was interesting, that shift there that happens. And I was wondering, because of the way she talks, I was wondering if she's saying there's a power that's going to do this thing. And it's not humanity, although it's going to be in humanity. I mean, she doesn't go on elaborating how this is going to work, but I just wondered if she was implying that. She talks about these visits he has, and love passes through his heart occasionally, and I don't know whether that's. That's right. She says, a strange and grandiose symbol was his birth. Pure perfection and a shadowless bliss are this afflicted creature's mighty fate.
And then the next line, so in him, the Earth Mother sees draw near the change. So I think that's why she came, because she sees that he is like the forerunner, the one who will be an instrument to bring it about.
But then by the end of her speech, she says, to the unchanging will, leave thy work's result. Don't demand any one boon only to greaten thy spirit demand. Don't ask for anything else. And this is another thing that's characteristic about the whole epic. I mean, we'll see this with Savitri, where she'll be tempted. Savitri will be tempted. Reminds me of the great three temptations of Christ. She'll be tempted to deviate from her destiny, from her dharma, and then when she refuses to do that, the supreme that's testing her will say, "What you said is my, you've said my word by your reply." So he accepts that what her refusal to give in to his tests were what he was after all along. So it's part of the process. So in this epic, you get to argue with the gods. In fact, you better.
It makes me think how every time I get kind of thrown back, as it were, down and persist, then there's always as there seems to be a rising up a little more. It's like you go up high and then you need to go back down again, and then you can maybe go a little bit higher and you're going to go back down again. Seems to be the human plight, to not give up, you know. And then to practice the faith that all things shall change in God's transfiguring hour, not mine.
You ready for me to go on? August and sweet, sank hushed thy mighty, that mighty voice. Nothing now moved in the vast brooding space. A stillness came upon the listening world, a mute immensity of the eternal's peace. But Aswapati's heart replied to her, a cry amid the silence of the vasts. How shall I rest content with mortal days and the dull measure of terrestrial things? I who have seen behind the cosmic mask the glory and the beauty of thy face. Hard is the doom to which thou bind'st thy sons. How long shall our spirits battle with the night and bear defeat and the brute yoke of death? We who are vessels of a deathless force and builders of the godhead of the race. Or if it is thy work I do below amid the error and waste of human life in the vague light of man's half-conscious mind, why breaks not in some distant gleam of thee? Ever the centuries and millenniums pass, where in the grayness is thy coming's ray? Where is the thunder of thy victory's wings? Only we hear the feet of passing gods.
A plan in the occult eternal mind mapped out to backward and prophetic sight. The eons ever repeat their changeless round. The cycles all rebuild and ever aspire. All we have done is ever still to do. All breaks and all renews and is the same. Huge revolutions of life's fruitless gyre. The newborn ages perish like the old, as if the sad enigma kept its right till all is done for which this scene was made. Too little the strength that now with us is born, too faint the light that steals through nature's lids, too scant the joy with which she buys our pain. In a brute world that knows not its own sense, thought wrecked upon the wheel of birth we live, the instruments of an impulse not our own, moved to achieve with our heart's blood for price, half knowledge, half creations that soon tire. A foiled immortal soul in perishing limbs, baffled and beaten back, we labor still. annulled, frustrated, spent, we still survive. In anguish we labor that from us may rise a larger seeing man with nobler heart, a golden vessel of the incarnate truth, the executor of the divine attempt, equipped to wear the earthly body of God, communicant and prophet and lover and king. I know that thy creation cannot fail, for even through the mists of mortal thought, infallible are thy mysterious steps. And though necessity dons the garb of chance, hidden in the blind shifts of fate, she keeps the slow, calm logic of infinity's pace and the inviolate sequence of its will. And life is fixed in an ascending scale, and adamantine is the evolving law. In the beginning is prepared the close.
This strange, irrational product of the mire, this compromise between the beast and God, is not the crown of thy miraculous world. I know there shall inform the inconscient cells, at one with nature and at height with heaven, a spirit vast as the containing sky and swept with ecstasy from invisible founts. A God come down and greater by the fall. A power arose out of my slumber cell, abandoning the tardy limp of the hours and the inconstant blink of mortal sight. There where the thinker sleeps in too much light and intolerant flames the lone all-witnessing eye, hearing the word of fate from silence's heart in the endless moment of eternity. It saw from timelessness the works of time, overpassed with the leaden formulas of the mind, overpowered the obstacle of mortal space. The unfolding image showed the things to come, a giant dance of Shiva tore the past. There was a thunder as of worlds that fall. Earth was o'errun with fire and the roar of death, clamoring to slay a world his hunger had made. There was a clangor of destruction's wings. The Titan's battle cry was in my ears. Alarm and rumor shook the armored night. I saw the omnipotence flaming pioneers over the heavenly verge which turns towards life come crowding down the amber stairs of birth. Forerunners of a mighty multitude, out of the path of the morning star, they came into the little room of mortal life.
I saw them cross the twilight of an age, the sun-eyed children of a marvelous dawn, the great creators with wide brows of calm, the massive barrier breakers of the world, and wrestlers with destiny in her lists of will, the laborers in the quarries of the gods, the messengers of the incommunicable, the architects of immortality. Into the fallen human sphere they came, faces that wore the immortal's glory still, voices that communed still with the thoughts of God, bodies made beautiful by the Spirit's light, carrying the magic word, the mystic fire, carrying the Dionysian cup of joy, approaching eyes of a diviner man, lips chanting an unknown anthem of the soul, feet echoing in the corridors of time. High priests of wisdom, sweetness, might, and bliss, discoverers of beauty's sunlit ways, and swimmers of love's laughing fiery floods, and dancers within rapture's golden doors, their tread one day shall change the suffering earth and justify the light on nature's face. Although fate lingers in the high beyond, and the work seems vain on which our heart's force was spent, all shall be done for which our pain was born. Even as of old man came behind the beast, this high divine successor surely shall come behind man's inefficient mortal pace, behind his vain labor, sweat and blood and tears. He shall know what mortal mind barely durst think. He shall do what the heart of the mortal could not dare. Inheritor of the toil of human time, he shall take on him the burden of the gods. All heavenly light shall visit the earth's thoughts. The might of heaven shall fortify earthly hearts. Earth's deeds shall touch the superhuman's height. Earth's seeing widen into the infinite.
Heavy unchanged weighs still the imperfect world. The splendid youth of time has passed and failed. Heavy and long are the years our labor counts, and still the seals are firm upon man's soul, and weary is the ancient mother's heart. O truth defended in thy secret son, voice of her mighty musings in shut heavens, on things withdrawn within her luminous depths. O wisdom splendor, mother of the universe, creatrix, the eternal's artist bride, linger not long with thy transmuting hand pressed vainly on one golden bar of time, as if time dare not open its heart to God. O radiant fountain of the world's delight, world free and unattainable above, O bliss ever dwelt'st deep hid within while men seek the outside and never find. Mystery and muse with hieratic tongue, incarnate the white passion of thy force, mission to earth some living form of thee. One moment fill with thy eternity, let thy infinity in one body live, all knowledge wrap one mind in seas of light, all love throb single in one human heart. Immortal, treading the earth with mortal feet, all heaven's beauty crowd in earthly limbs. Omnipotence, girdle with the power of God movements and moments of immortal will, packed with the eternal, might one human hour, and with one gesture, change all future time. Let a great word be spoken from the heights, and one great act unlocked the doors of fate. Need to ring the bells.
Here's the passage that has spoken to many of us. You know, especially in the early days in Oroville, I saw the omnipotence flaming pioneers over the heavenly verge, which turns towards life, come crowding down the amber stairs of birth. Forerunners of a divine multitude, out of the paths of the morning star, they came into the little room of mortal life. I saw them cross the twilight of an age, the sun-eyed children of a marvelous dawn, the great creators with wide brows of calm, the massive barrier breakers of the world, the wrestlers with destiny in her lists of will, the laborers in the quarries of the gods, the messengers of the incommunicable, the architects of immortality. Into the fallen human sphere they came, faces that wore the immortal's glory still, voices that commune still with the thoughts of God, bodies made beautiful by the Spirit's light, carrying the magic word, the mystic fire, carrying the Dionysian cup of joy, approaching eyes of a diviner man, lips chanting an unknown anthem of the soul, feet echoing in the corridors of time. High priests of wisdom, sweetness, might, and bliss, discoverers of beauty's sunlit ways, and swimmers of love's laughing fiery floods, and dancers within rapture's golden doors, their tread one day shall change the suffering earth and justify the light on nature's face.
Shall we read on to the end? I think there's a page and a half to go or something.
Yeah, let's do that.
2.5 pages.
I want to reply to what you just shared, Andrea, but I think we should save it.
Would you read on, Andrea?
Okay.
I don't want to read the last little bit. And then...
Sure. His prayer sank down in the resisting night, oppressed by the thousand forces that deny, as if too weak to climb to the supreme. But there arose a wide, consenting voice. The spirit of beauty was revealed in sound. Light floated round the marvelous vision's brow, and on her lips, the immortal's joy took shape. O strong forerunner, I have heard thy cry. One shall descend and break the iron law, change nature's doom by the lone spirit's power. A limitless mind that can contain the world, a sweet and violent heart of ardent calms, moved by the passions of the gods, shall come. All mights and greatnesses shall join in her. Beauty shall walk celestial on the earth. Delight shall sleep in the cloud net of her hair. And in her body, as on his homing tree, immortal love shall beat his glorious wings. A music of griefless things shall weave her charm. The harps of the perfect shall attune her voice. The streams of heaven shall murmur in her laugh. Her lips shall be the honeycombs of God. Her limbs, his golden jars of ecstasy. Her breasts, the rapture flowers of paradise. She shall bear wisdom in her voiceless bosom. Strength shall be with her like a conqueror's sword, and from her eyes the eternal's bliss shall gaze. A seed shall be sown in death's tremendous hour, a branch of heaven transplant to human soil. Nature shall overleap her mortal step. Fate will be changed by an unchanging will. as a flame disappears in endless light, immortally extinguished in its source, vanished the splendor and was stilled the word. An echo of delight that once was close, the harmony journeyed towards some distant hush, a music failing in the ear of trance, a cadence called by distant cadences, a voice that trembled into strains withdrawn.
Her form retreated from the longing earth, forsaking nearness to the abandoned sense, ascending to her unattainable home. Lone, brilliant, vacant, lay the inner fields. All was unfilled, inordinate spirit space, indifferent, waste, a desert of bright peace. Then a line moved on the far edge of calm, the warm-lipped, sentient, soft terrestrial wave. A quick and many murmured moan and laugh came gliding in upon white feet of sound. Unlocked was the deep glory of silence's heart, the absolute unmoving stillnesses surrendered to the breath of mortal air, dissolving boundlessly. The heavens of trance collapsed to waking mind. Eternity cast down its incommunicable lids over its solitudes, remote from kin, behind the voiceless mystery of sleep. The grandiose respite failed, the wide release. Across the light of fast receding planes that fled from him as from a falling star, compelled to fill its human house in time, his soul drew back into the speed and noise of the vast business of created things. A chariot of the marvels of the heavens, broad-based to bear the gods on fiery wheels, flaming, he swept through the spiritual gates. The mortal stir received him in its midst. Once more he moved amid material scenes, lifted by intimations from the heights and in the pauses of the building brain, touched by the thoughts that skim the fathomless surge of nature and wing back to hidden shores. The eternal seeker in the ionic field, besieged by the intolerant press of hours, again was strong for great swift-footed deeds.
Awake beneath the ignorant vault of night, he saw the unnumbered people of the stars and heard the questioning of the unsatisfied flood and toiled with the form maker. Measuring mind. A wanderer from the occult invisible suns, accomplishing the fate of transient things, a god in the figure of the arisen beast. He raised his brow of conquest to the heavens, establishing the empire of the soul on matter and its bounded universe. As on a solid rock in infinite seas. The Lord of Life resumed his mighty rounds in the scant field of the ambiguous globe. End of book 3, canto 4, end of part 1.
So here's the first section in this whole magnificent work, where the mother is described. One shall descend and break the iron law.
Is this also the promise of Savitri?
Oh, of course, of course. Yeah, sorry. I'm, you know, yes, Savitri. For me, there's no difference, you know. Savitri is the mother, just as Aswapati is Sri Aurobindo. Because it's a symbol, right? The whole thing is a legend and a symbol, and it is a symbol of them and their journey and their work and their manifestation. Yes, Savitri.
Is there like a generational sort of aspect to this vision? The reason I ask is because this was written right between the 30s and 40s, 50s, and then in the 60s we had this, you know, great flowering, this social and cultural flowering all over the world of kind of new consciousness and the flower children. And, you know, Blake came to mind through as we were reading this. I forgot his exact, but it was like the children of joy, right? Like this Dionysian cupbearers. And there's so much that is described here, which I think is redolent of that wave that emerged and, you know, the sense of a new age.
Right. And so, of course, we all came there from the 60s, right? In the 60s and 70s is when we came there. And, you know, over the, this beautiful line over the path of the morning star, out of the path of the morning star they came. Yeah, I saw them cross the twilight of an age. And so that's right there, you know. I do feel that.
Sounds like Woodstock. It sounds a little bit like Woodstock to me.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a different quality to Sri Aurobindo's poetry than to, I think, the counterculture. But there are definitely overlaps.
And it was a massive awakening on the planet, you know. The Woodstock time, it was.
We were there.
Yeah, John Lennon was our prophet. Changed everything. And then we all trekked to India. And some of us got lucky.
And it reminds me of Neil Young. Is it Neil Young's song, Woodstock? Is that Neil Young's song?
It's Joni Mitchell.
Oh, it's Joni Mitchell's song. Yeah, Woodstock. Yeah.
She wasn't there. She didn't make it. But she saw the TV and she wrote that song. And I was thinking about that song when Marco was talking about the 60s. Yeah. We've got to get ourselves back to the garden.
Yeah, that line. Oh. Oh.
I've heard some really beautiful, I've one in particular beautiful rendition where she is playing solo with a piano. And it's somewhere on the website, actually. And I dreamed that.
So was that not with Crosby, Stills, and Nash?
I think they covered it, but it was.
But she sang with them for a little while, didn't she? It's my memory. Anyway,
not that I know.
You all know the song.
They did record it, but she also recorded it.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I think though, to me, like in retrospect, there's a difference too. Like because there was a certain, let's say, like flowering or like explosion of spiritual, visionary, you know, like insight and culture But what he's describing here also is a bit different because it's such a long, it's a journey too. And I think like that, a lot of that flowering has kind of fallen away, or it's become like commercialized, or it's become like subsumed within capitalism, essentially. And yet there's still the path, and there's still the work to be done, and there's still, you know, this crucible that we're passing through. And in a way, there's like the innocence of that initial explosion, and that awakening then has to like meet the harsh reality of like getting of actually manifesting and actually incarnating it over time and on the larger scale of a world of a planet. And the feeling I get from Aurobindo is not this, I mean, there's the Dionysian element, but there's also this strong Apollinian quality, like the quality of order and sort of a far seeingness, that I think is, it's related, but it's also different. And, you know, a lot of people who were initiated in the 60s, I think, in a way, like fell away from it, like, and they kind of fell back into that vision that in a way that the mother is suggesting to Ashwapati here, like, go back to your everyday life and, you know, things will work themselves out, you know, don't worry about the big picture. Whereas some became even more, like, some became intense practitioners over decades of time and like stuck with a path, and, you know, developed something out of it, maybe a community or any number of like things. So I think it's an interesting, it'd be a really interesting study perhaps to look at the relationships between Sri Aurobindo's yoga and the integral yoga and like 60s counterculture and like how those unfurled, you know, over the decades now, like what, 50 years practically, right?
If you look now at our culture, the presence of meditation and yoga and spiritual journeys and spiritual centers are blossoming. It's everywhere. It wasn't there in the 60s. That wasn't there. It's
a meditation app, and I can scroll through just teachers and teachers.
There's thousands. So
many, yeah.
Right. So, you know, it's continuing. And then one line when you were talking about this coming down, this line is so amazing. A God come down and greater by the fall. To me, that is such a pregnant line.
It transmutes maybe the sense of tragedy or the sense of
absolutely
guilt, even, you know, for
absolutely
that.
Right.
And it's part of that, it's kind of a longer, wider version of that arc and this up and descent and ascent and descent rhythm, right, that Andrea was talking about earlier.
Yeah.
That happens
like just before that
society-wide scale.
Right. Just before that section about the, I saw the omnipotence flaming pioneers, he describes a giant dance of Shiva, which we could say is happening right now. Earth is overrun with fire and the roar of death. So the scene continues.
Going back to something that Marco said a little bit back, there was a conference in, I think it was in 2018, at the California Institute of Integral Studies, which was founded by a disciple of Sri Aurobindo. In San Francisco, a conference on integral yoga and the 60s.
Mm.
weekend conference. There were some Aurevilleans who were there, and Michael Murphy, who spent time at the ashram. So
that would be interesting. CIIS, I don't know how far back they go, but they've been posting archives of their talks on their website. I found some really some gems there.
Oh yeah. So both the CIIS and Esalen, they're both founded by people who were inspired by Sri Aurobindo. The forerunners.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely been a dissemination and a kind of maturation too of, and even the commercialization of it in a way is it, a way of it becoming embodied and becoming incarnated, just in the forms of that are available, like the economic forms that are available. It doesn't mean it's the end of it necessarily, you know, that.
No, I think she uses everything. That's the secret. Everything is part of the part of how the. I don't know how he has some amazing lines about that.
Now, in terms of the story, this is where the birth of Savitri, the character of Savitri, who I presume we'll meet in the next part of the book, where that birth is prophesied, announced.
This is where she agrees to come down, right?
So Savitri is like an emanation of the mother, an incarnation.
Exactly. Yes, daughter of the sun, giving, being born in human form to Ashwapati.
Savitri is a symbol of what then? Or who?
The divine mother.
Well,
Ashwapati is the symbol of the human being. Just like Satyavan is, I mean, maybe I should say Satyavan is the symbol of the human soul, and Savitri is the symbol of the daughter of the sun, the word. She comes to bring the boons into human life, to wage the battle.
There's a post-human kind of moment here too, where the human is, there's sort of the anticipation of the superhuman, the super mind, this next.
Yeah.
Savitri, would you say a symbol of that?
Yeah. Of bringing that, of the first manifestation of that in humanity. Because she becomes human. She takes birth.
Okay.
Yeah.
Curious about the last line, last two lines. The Lord of Life resumed his mighty rounds in the scant field of the ambiguous globe. And the his, Lord of Life, referred to here is obviously not the mother, because that would be her. And it's not Ashwapati, because he's the petitioner here in this scene. So what is the connection there? Like, is this the Father, like God the Father kind of thing? Or is there some meaning that I'm missing?
John Robert?
It's Ashwapati.
Really? Okay. Huh. Mm-hmm.
He saw this whole last section, well, not the last section, but the last page, if you start on page 347, his soul drew back, and his soul is coming back to earth out of this long trance that he's been in. And it was, again, strong for swift-footed deeds, awake between. He saw the unnumbered people. All of this is he. He raised his brow, conquest to the heavens, establishing the empire of soul on matter. It's all talking about Ashwapati.
But it wouldn't be Ashwapati, like just the mortal man. Like, this is the aspect of like the absolute, or the masculine Godhead.
Yeah. Yeah, and we've heard Sri Aurobindo talk about him that way. I mean, when we first meet him, Ashwapati, in the beginning of the book, he's described as a descent of the eternal into humanity. Says to him to go back and resume his work. And that's what he's doing. The Lord of Life resumes his mighty rounds in the scant field of the ambiguous globe. Of course, I'm speaking as if I know everything. I obviously don't. No, I obviously don't know everything. I mean, that's the way I've always read it. So.
Yeah, for me, actually that last line, the Lord of Life, that seems more like the divine itself. But I find it a bit of a leap for Ashwapati to be called the Lord of Life. But it's interesting. Who knows?
It's been talking about him. I mean, that the lines have been talking about him all along, and
yeah,
he's come back to mm-hmm. resume his work.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's untoward to have Sri Aurobindo called him the Lord of Life. He's an incarnation of the Lord of Life.
Uh-huh.
There is a few lines before that. Where it says, "A god in the figure of the arisen beast, he raised his brow of conquest to the heavens." So, can we see Ashwapati as a face of, a mask of, or a kind of vessel for the Lord of Life, or the divine? So when we say Ashwapati, we're referring to the man, but the man is, as you said earlier, Andrea, like the being through whom mm-hmm. the divine mind, the transcendental, the Lord of Life, expresses it. Himself becomes manifest.
If we look at the author's note at the very beginning of the book, Sri Aurobindo talks about the tale and so on, and he says, Ashwapati, the Lord of the Horse, your human father, is the Lord of Tapasya, and Lord is capitalized, the concentrated energy of spiritual endeavor. And then he goes on to say, Still, this is not mere allegory. The characters are not personified qualities, but incarnations of, or emanations of living and conscious forces with whom we may enter into concrete touch. So Sherbino says what these characters represent.
Yeah. And they take human bodies in order to help man and show him the way.
Exactly. Right.
Mm-hmm. To a divine right. Consciousness.
It's the only way it'll work, yeah.
And Ashwapati is related to the Ash Winds, right? So, which we learned as the Lords of Bliss.
And Ashwapati has been doing this tapasya, this spiritual practice, and as a human being, he's been doing it. That's the only way it could be accomplished. So he's been doing the work of life's evolution in rising up so where he can actually meet the mother and actually and stand on equal ground with her, have an argument with her and insist on what he wants. And then she says, yes, that is what I want. Also,
I was really struck by the last few lines here. A god in the figure of the arisen beast. He raised his brow of conquest to the heavens, establishing the empire of the soul on matter and its bounded universe as on a solid rock in infinite seas. Like that's what he does. It's quite something. He establishes the empire of the soul on matter. I think that's why we continue to read Sri Aurobindo.
I want to make one other comment about the 60s and that discussion we were having a little earlier. So Sri Aurobindo left his body in 1950. And Mother's Yoga continued on until 1973. So during the 60s, she was really doing the yoga of matter. And so that was going on in Pondicherry without a lot of fanfare and without Sri Aurobindo specifically writing about it, since he had left during the 60s.
Well, he left us this.
What was the relation between the community in Pondicherry and the wider movement of, you know, everything that was going on ecologically, the sexual revolution, the politics, the wars, Vietnam, etc. Did you see yourselves as part of that movement or part of a larger movement?
There were two different things. There's the Sri Aurobindo Ashram, which was really focused on the individual sadhana. That was in Pondicherry. And then Mother founded Oroville. Oroville is 8 miles north of Pondicherry. And that's where we all trotted to start building this city of dawn out of nothing. You know, it was just a desert. And I think we were more representations of the earth and doing collective sadhana, which is what Mother saw was needed for the transformation for humanity, that there would be a collective experiment in consciousness, whereas in the ashram it's really focused on the individual development.
Okay, I didn't understand that. So there's the ashram, and then yeah. There's Oroville. They're different.
Right. Yes, they're vastly different. There are many people from the ashram who are involved with Oroville and who have helped. But they are really two entirely different entities. Hmm. Yeah.
perhaps we'll have a conversation another time. We could have a more full conversation about that experiment. That's really fascinating. Mm-hmm. I have friends who've been there. Of course, you're friends and you've been there, but I mean, other friends. It's still hard to fathom just kind of the act of founding a city, like, and that's like an intentional city.
Yeah.
I suppose people were doing that. They were doing communes and things like that, but it seems like this is a little different in its structure and intentions.
Well, this was Mother's
To found a city in the desert where there wasn't anything. I mean, there were some villages around, but right, the place where she put her finger on the map and said, here it is.
And she said that she had seen the tree. She had seen the banyan tree as the geographical center of Orville. And they found a tree. And when they were there and they communicated with Mother, she agreed that was the one. And so the banyan tree is still growing, is now completely protected. You know what banyan trees do? They grow these roots from their branches. So the whole thing becomes like a forest in itself. The one tree becomes like a forest with many trunks going down. It's an extraordinary tree. And it is right next to the Matrimandir. So Matrimandir, the banyan tree, and the urn are the geographical center of Oroville.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Oroville is interesting.
Andreas,
I think it's the most interesting place in the world myself.
Andrea shared with me a video of the forests around Oroville and how the forests are worked with and preserved. And I thought it was interesting because it kind of gave you a kind of sense a little bit about Aurobindo and the vision behind it. Even though that wasn't really the focus of the video, it kind of couldn't avoid giving you something about that, you know, so.
Yeah, so we planted so many trees because we needed to preserve the land, right? And it was a desert, you can't live in a desert. And we planted so many trees that I don't know, 1.5 million trees. I mean, the whole thing turned into a jungle. It's like the city started to be built by growing the jungle. I couldn't recognize the place when I came back in 2000, because all of a sudden you're under the trees. And all we had was just this vast open space, right? With nothing.
So there are issues now because the trees are being harvested by companies. And so there's a kind of a little bit of a power struggle between the community of Oroville and the companies who want to harvest the trees. But of course the trees were planted mostly by the, by Oroville.
Yeah.
Perhaps we could share that video.
Yeah, there's also a really wonderful video about the construction of the Matrimandir from the very beginning to now. Do you go to Facebook?
I don't.
No, okay, I'll send them around.
Didn't you share it the other time? I think we talked about it. And there's a Vimeo video. I don't know if you had a look into it, Marco, but it's about an hour about the building of the temple.
Yeah, it's quite wonderful.
I have it in a queue.
Among the 1,000 things you would like to pay attention to.
Marco, put a visit.
Otherwise, it all gets lost in the vast, you know, vast sea of details. But,
yes.
Put a visit to the Matrimandir in your queue.
That's
really amazing.
Yeah. I'm just waiting for the girls to grow up a little bit, be able to get away or bring
might
them.
Might be interesting for them to see it too, because it's fascinating. It's like watching the pyramids being built. It's like
beyond anything, you know, almost beyond anything we have ever done. It's like the pyramids or the Great Wall of China. There's the Mata Mandir. It's there on that scale.
On that scale, in terms of spiritual significance or in terms of sheer size, is it very big?
Sheer undertaking.
Because it was built mostly by hand, using you know, engineering hoists and things like that. But most of the manpower that went into was local people. So
it was us. It was just us and
villagers. It's not like an engineering firm coming and building a building. It's not like that at all.
So. No.
Interesting. Okay, well.
I mean, it was designed, I guess, by an engineering firm, but the actual building was...
No, it was designed by a mother's grandson who was a French architect.
Right. Yeah.
And then there was an Italian engineer who was in charge, but all the labor was completely unskilled. Us, we did it with our own hands to perfection. It was amazing. It's just amazing. And then with you know, hundreds of villagers helping to do the hard labor, you know, like just the excavation itself is like a primordial thing.
Wow. Yeah. It must seem so overwhelming at first, and then.
Yeah, it was.
Years and decades to see how it actually has taken shape and transformed. Yes.
Yeah.
It must be really satisfying.
Yeah, it's remarkable. Yeah. Okay, shall we call it a day?
I guess next time we'll reread the vision and the boon.
Yeah.
I'll share a Joni Mitchell version of Woodstock that I really like.
Yes, please.
Okay. I'm sure you've heard it before, but
yes.
For me, you can never hear. And then I was like hearing it for the first time when I heard her sing it. Because I'd heard the Crosby, Stills, and Nash version, and that was the one that was kind of had impressed itself.
Yeah.
But the original, just her solo voice and piano is amazing.
Yeah, I'd love to hear that. Yeah.
She's an amazing singer, performer, composer, anyway. So.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so
much. Okay.
This has been wonderful.
So do you want a meditation to finish? Do you want me to do the bell again?
Thank you, everybody.
Yeah, another wonderful trip here around the universe.
Bye bye. Marco, we're on at 3:30 your time.
Correct. Looking forward to that very much. A very poetic day I'm having today. with another poem later by Mary Thaler, who's an editor with a friend of Jeffrey Jen's. And that's a very different poem than this.
I think Andrea's read it, actually. I shared it with her.
Which one? Which poem?
Elfider, the Viking.
Oh, yes, yeah. I have. Yeah. Different universe. Different part of the universe.
Different part of the universe, that's right.
But and Jocelyn should be there, too, to talk about the music. So
I've heard. And some connections, though, this sort of, you know, suck it up and be a man thing, or be a woman, I think. I think part of an interesting overlap. Anyway, good to see you all. Thank you so much. And next time.
Bye-bye.
See you next time. Bye-bye.